KPZALP, Petaluma, California, 103.3 FM. Good morning and welcome to Inside Petaluma. I'm Cindy Thomas, co-hosting with Jason Davies and Janice Gator Thompson.
Good morning, Petaluma.
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Yeah, another Friday.
Yeah.
We always get together on Friday.
I think we do. I think it's about the same time, too.
Yeah, because our show is every Friday.
Yeah,
we're reliable that way.
We are very reliable that way.
Yeah. So, any dog stories, Janice?
Oh, God, any dog stories. Coco was supposed to be a dog that didn't shed, and that is not true. She's a fluffer. So she gets fluff hair around the house all the time, but I still love her, and she's sweet.
It's just not fur, it's hair.
It is not, that is true. Yes, but no good Coco stories this week, except she's a perfect dog. She's known as Coco the Wonder Dog.
My dogs are at the groomer right now.
Oh.
Yeah. They always get really excited to get in the car, and then when we get down to the street where we get to the groomer, it's like their head goes down.
They know the routine.
Did we all watch the impeachment debate?
I watched quite a bit of it. It's, it's almost like you didn't even need to watch it. You knew what the outcome was going to be and what was being said. And what was frightening when I was driving here today, I'm hearing about how Betsy DeVos is really going to change education. And it is frightening what's happening.
It was an interesting spectacle. I was both dismayed and also inspired. We have some really great people in Congress that understand the Constitution and the importance to defend it, and we have some others that are putting their own political viability and party above country, and they're not putting America first, and that's unfortunate.
There's a statement in the White House.
There's a statement I heard last night, though. I mean, I heard a lot of, let's use malarkey. I heard a lot of malarkey. But this was just hysterical, and I don't know if anyone else caught it, but this is from California Republican Tom McClintock.
Here's
his quote. This is just beautiful. My son and I looked at each other and just caught it instantly and went, "What the heck?" No matter how many times you repeat facts, it doesn't make them true. Think about that one for a second.
Yeah.
No matter how many times you repeat facts, it doesn't make them true. Now, of course, the very definition of fact is a thing known or proved to be true. So that's I don't know if he was intentional. I think what he probably meant to say was the people that are purporting to have facts or, repeating them or something. But it just, that's the reality, and I thought it was...
Well, I was just doing some fact-checking on yellow journalism.
Yeah.
And, yellow journalism is alive, even our own community.
Oh, of course.
And so, that statement is very much what would come from Randolph Hearst. Go ahead and you continue, painting the pictures of the war, and I'll finish the war. And, that's journalism, and it is frightening what's happening.
Very Orwellian. Anyway, switch gears, get back to local stuff. We've got the Emerald Cup happening this weekend.
And are you going?
I don't know if I'm going or not. I did apply for a press pass, and I don't know if I submitted it too late or they just didn't find Inside Petaluma to be interesting enough for them, or I'm not sure. But I didn't get a response this time. We did get press passes last time.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, it's $100. Obviously, if I had a pass right now, I'd be gleefully recommending it to everybody, and but since they didn't give me a pass, I'm going to say, hey, it should be an interesting event. Anyone who's interested should go check it out. I'm not sure if I'm going to go or not. It does cost money to go in if you don't have a press pass, and $100. I mean,
you can get $100 worth of product with that.
Exactly.
I think that's enough.
The goal, I think a shorter trip would be to the dispensary probably.
Oh, 26% tax on the dispensary?
Anyway, but you know, I think that's kind of a nice lead-in that we're talking about that because we have a. Well, do you want to introduce our guest?
Well, do you want to, Jason?
Well, normally the host does that. We're just co-hosts.
We're co-hosts.
We're co-hosts amongst us.
We're co-hosts together.
So we're thrilled to have Frances Rivetti with us, who's a local author who's written quite a few interesting books, and she has a new book called Big Green Country. And Frances, tell us a little bit about you and about this book.
Well, hi. Thank you for having me in here today on this rainy Friday.
Yeah, it's great to see you. I feel like I know you from Facebook, but it's nice to meet you.
Yes. I know. We all know each other from...
I was telling her that I feel like we should be drinking wine right now because that's what usually I do with Frances.
Oh, really? And usually, and really for the past 10, 12 years, I have been writing about wine and cheese and beer and all the wonderful... organic farm-to-table foods in our region, and I had a column in the Argus Courier for 5 years where I pretty much focused on that era where we were, all our wonderful farms were figuring out how to stay viable and creating beautiful organic products. And my first two books, Fog Valley Crush and Fog Valley Winter, grew out of that column when I put that on hold and focused on developing those stories, wonderful stories from our region, into more depth. And after the last book, the second book, Fog Valley Winter, came out about 3 years ago, I had so much support from local readership and encouragement to fictionalize my work on the region. I think I have a lot of readers that are Doc Martin fans and of the TV program in Cornwall. I said, can't you do something like that here, based here with your books? And I thought, gosh, that would be interesting. I'm a journalist by trade, trained as a journalist in the UK before I came to California. And I'd obviously dreamed about writing fiction like most people do. You know, oh, I think I have a novel in me. But I hadn't turned my hand to that. And I thought, well, I'll give it a go. I'll try. So I spent the first couple of months of researching and trying to figure out how to make a novel out of fine wine and cheese. And I just wasn't clicking. It wasn't coming. Wasn't flowing as fiction. I can write all day long reports and articles and nonfiction on that subject matter, but it wasn't. Fictionalizing in my head. Mm-hmm. And around that time, three and a half years ago, I was getting invited as a freelance journalist to lots and lots of very interesting meetings, private and public, with pro and against cannabis legislation, farmers and ranch owners and neighbors and businesses. And really going with an open mind and listening to what everybody had to say and all the genuine concerns and all the genuine reasons to push our legislation through and, you know, end a lot of the criminal elements. But that all ties in together, as we know, with a lot of the controversy. So I it just clicked. I thought, oh my goodness, I write about agricultural history and development, and really that was the story of 3.5 years ago when this in our community. Mm-hmm. And once I started researching into that and the history of cannabis in Northern California and what's developed in the last few years, I just was captivated by the subject matter, and I decided to make that my focus. Or it decided for me to make it my focus. And I created a fictional family based out of Sonoma Coast. Mm-hmm. And
family that you met? Was it based on...
No, it's a completely fictional family. Right. But a family that we would all identify with in this region. And I've told the story, the contemporary cannabis story of our region through this family and the saga that entails.
Yeah, I can't wait to read it.
I know, very exciting.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, you can kind of have a history back with your father growing up in journalism.
Well, I grew up in the Fens. I don't know if too many people are familiar with the Fenland area, but it's Cambridgeshire, Lincolnshire, Norfolk borders, and about 100 miles north of London, and it's very, very rustic and rural, and sort of off the beaten track. Not a lot of tourists get beyond Cambridge to go out into that fenland countryside, and it's dense farmland. So I think my connection with the farming culture here definitely stems from growing up in that, in a small town around the size of Cutati. And my dad, my granddad was the local greengrocer, and my dad was the newsagent, sold newspapers in town. So between them, they had sort of the monopoly on it. And I learned to drive, actually, this is kind of fun, and it ties into my rambling around this region, finding stories. I learned to drive at 17 in the my granddad's grocery delivery van out in the fens. So we would drop off boxes of food to different remote farms, and there was a lady that was employed to do those deliveries at that time who was nominated to teach me to do those initial driving. And I remember being a little, I'm very cautious by personality, and I remember driving, she'd say, okay, we're going to stop at that turn, we're going to stop at that farm half a mile down the road, okay? And I'd already start braking and indicating. But so I have very much interest in the history of our agricultural heritage, and hence my connection to this region. And
I also have a connection, obviously, to farming. My dad was actually president of Farm Bureau and was instrumental in starting farm trails.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, this is back in the 70s.
Yeah, oh, wonderful.
Yeah, and Mrs. Kraut, who had Kraut Pheasant Farm, recently passed away. And I went to her service, and it was so amazing how strong of a woman she was and how she, you know, made this pheasant farm successful.
Yes,
and with, you know, her four boys, and it was really interesting learning about her, but it goes back to the days in the 70s, starting the farm trails.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's...
I mean, I could really write for years on all these wonderful heritage stories, and probably only just scratched the surface with those first two books. And even with the new book, people stop me all the time and say, oh, you have to come and talk to this person or meet someone who has some crazy story for me. And, you know, at a certain point, I have to focus in on what I'm trying to do with that story and wait for a later date to pick up all the extra stories that are coming my way.
So you started with writing for newspapers.
I started in the UK. Actually, I was very fortunate in... vocational training was still in its heyday over there. I think they're kind of turning back to that in the UK now, as the universities are saturated and it costs a lot of money to go to university in the UK as well now, where it didn't back then. But I was hired by my local newspaper at 18, straight out of high school, and to do vocational training. So they sent me off on a 10-month course just north of London, to learn all the basics, court reporting and legal stuff and shorthand. And can you imagine now people using shorthand?
Only in the movies.
Yeah, but it was great. And it was such a fun time, and made lots of friends that went off to newspapers around the UK that I'm still in touch with several of them, and interesting to follow their journalistic careers around the world now. But I, after the first 10 months, then I was... into this newspaper group in the area where I grew up, so Rural Titles, similar to the Argus Courier. And they rotated us through the group for 2 years, and then was working full-time, paid full-time, you know, independent of my parents, and took my journalistic qualifications at the end of that full 3 years. And so by 21, I was fully qualified, and I had been... the only... reporter on the beat on a Saturday morning, if there was a murder story in the next town, then it was mine. So it was initiation by fire.
No kidding.
So you mentioned in your bio here on your website that you would drive around in a Mini Cooper door knocking on investigative assignments.
Yes.
But you didn't like it.
Well, I liked some of it. I really love to write about culture and heritage and people, and right. I didn't like the, I wasn't ever going to be a natural crime reporter, although, interestingly enough, I do write that. I have been able to develop that skill into
as fiction.
Into my novels. So it's a different way of doing. But I didn't like the intrusion on tragedies and intruding on families in tragic situations. And although I was good at it, I have to say, and people would open their door and tell me the stories. But I feel like I was able to. When we debate about journalism today, I was able to do that in a very clear-hearted way and tell their story for the betterment of, of, you know, their needs, the victim's needs, as opposed to exploiting the story. But I didn't think that I wanted to go on and be a be a tabloid journalist.
Yeah.
Investigative reporting, it's something that is almost a lost art.
Yes.
And that's what's really unfortunate. We used to, in Petaluma, we had Dave Alcott. He was an amazing investigative reporter.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I got to use all my investigative reporter skills for this novel. Have huge files full of research. But it takes time and for newspapers to hire journalists to be able to do that amount of work and time. I think that's what's happened is the funding. But I think
that's
we
exactly
are,
what it is.
But I think we are seeing, you know, I've seen that. What happened with the demise of newspapers and magazines and all the online push 15 years ago or so. And I think we are, as journalists, seeing a lot more potential and opportunities arising now going through all this political crisis around the world for sources to support good, especially independent journalism.
Well, the investigative reporting, there's a group and they're out of Oakland.
Yes.
And so it's just very important.
And a lot of the young journalists coming through, you know, really phenomenal.
We have the Project Censored people locally that do a lot of investigative journalism. it's a deep field, but it's a tough market now with a lot of digital media. I mean, musicians are having the same problem, you know, in terms of being able to make money. I mean, the internet has created this sort of expectation that all content should be free.
Yes, yeah.
And so that's also hitting journalism. And, I mean, I do it myself. I'll go online and read things without subscribing just because I can.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't do that. But
well, I think we all should subscribe to, you know, at least a couple of really good sources for journalism and feel good about that, even if you don't. I mean, I subscribe to the New Yorker and the New York Times and, you know, the local, the August Courier and several other publications. I don't always get to read the New Yorker like I would like to time-wise, but I do get access to their online stories too, so any really important story I read, and I feel I'm very proud that I get to contribute to keeping them funded, even if I don't always have time to read the whole thing all the way through.
Yeah, it's a good thing. I mean, every time I go and watch my limited number of free articles per month.
Yeah, 10 is the magic number.
Yeah, then I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. You know, but then there's the thing is there's so much access to so much free news, including Associated Press, you know, or BBC. I mean, I can go to all of these sites online.
I think the key is finding where you feel really comfortable when you find the right source that speaks to you and that you trust, and then make that commitment. I would encourage everyone to do that. Next year, make a commitment to one trusted news source and help them thrive. And
I think I might do that with the Washington Post. Anyway.
Well, I went to online, you know, instead of hard copies. And I miss my hard copies of the newspapers.
Yes.
And so I'm kind of in a transition trying to decide what do I really want. But holding that paper and reading it, I like that. But then I like to get online because then I can go back to certain paragraphs that I'm looking for. So I feel like I'm in one of those in-betweens, not really sure what direction I want to go. But I've definitely taken the online on.
Yeah, I subscribe to the New York Times paper edition on Sundays, and having raised three sons, I think exposing them to having that newspaper around all week and picking up the style and design publications and that are included in there and all the different elements of the newspapers, and they've all gone up. My sons have all gone on to have really, you know, interesting starts to their careers, and they're very informed. So I think as parents too, we having hard copies of publications around you know, you're definitely sowing the seeds for the next generation to mm-hmm. to look at, pick up something they might not normally have been drawn
right.
to. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, there's something to be said for printed news still also, because it makes you focus on the actual news and the paper in front of you instead of on a computer where you're bombarded with pop-up ads and maybe
well,
you get an email.
That's the other thing I'm getting tired of.
So there is yeah. something to be said for the focus of that.
Well, I think we have to train ourselves to read through a full article, too.
Yeah.
Well,
you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, retrain yeah. ourselves, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's true. Sometimes we skim, I will say that. Just give me the meat of it, you know.
Well, it depends on whose meat it is.
So this book is out. It's available now.
Yes, it is.
And this
yes.
is called Big Green Country. It's a novel, and it can be purchased locally.
Yes, Copperfields are ordering and should have some in stock by now.
Did you already do a big book signing and we missed it?
I didn't this time. I did do that with the first two books, and it was fun and exciting mm-hmm. and a lot of organizing. Mm-hmm. And with this one, it took me twice as long to write mm-hmm. the fictional piece as the nonfiction. So after 3.5 years, it was getting to this winter period, and I just thought, I'm going to do a massive push and get it out in time for the holidays for a soft entry into the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as people are buying books to share for gifts and wanting to share stories from our region. And so I really kind of pulled out all the stops to get it out. And I got my first copies the night before Thanksgiving, and I was hosting 10 and people and several of UC Davis students with my youngest son, and I thought, I can do it all. I can launch a book and host and roll into the holidays. Why not?
How'd that work for you?
Absolutely. But I made the decision. I've been doing a couple of smaller events this month, but I've made the decision to postpone setting the public launch until, I think, early February, once we've all settled down from the holidays. And then I'm going to do something. I've got a couple of different venues that have actually invited me to do something, so we're working on that. And I think, you know, I'd like to make it public so everyone can come. And
so you haven't really done a big press launch yet? No reviews yet?
I'm just starting that process. Because I figured just do a
soft launch.
Yes, yeah, and then January can roll into that. But because of the subject matter is on everybody's minds right now, it's taken on a natural little role of its own getting mm-hmm. out there. And also our fantastic community. We have so many wonderful readers and writers and creators who you know, everybody pulls in together and spreads the word. And so, you know, several hundred copies that I received are already out there locally, which is wonderful. So it's a grassroots literally launch for December, and then I'll get into all the full marketing mode in January.
Yeah, you almost have to have everything already in the bag probably several months before if you wanted to do like a winter launch.
Yeah, every time I produce one now, this is my third book, you know, I learn something new. And I think for me as an author, I whatever I write, I really write from the heart, and so the marketing promotional side, don't tell my husband, I hope he's not listening, comes second to me,
you know. I mean, I think it should.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the art should be first, and then obviously you have to think about how you're going to market it. And but
it's got a lot of potential. I have been getting a lot of feedback from readers that have so many questions. Every chapter in this book has multiple discussion points for mm-hmm. our region. And so I'm going to put together that's the next thing on my list, is to put together a reader's book group discussion guide, because it should really incite some great debate amongst book groups, especially, you know, some people smoke a lot of weed, some people don't want anything to do with it, but, you know, all the pros and cons of dispensaries opening and, you know, all the hot topics.
What are the cons?
Well, there's
that it's not free.
There's still a lot of people. There are still many, many people that would like to think that it's not legal and it's not here and it's not going to.
I think those people, if they want to be consistent, they should be in favor of alcohol prohibition as well.
Yeah.
And that really, I really get tired of these the hypocrisy there. I mean, here we're in Sonoma County. We have all these craft beer places. We've got wineries and all of that stuff. It's okay.
That's all being promoted.
Yeah, but it's not okay to have. I know it's still federally illegal. I know that's part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like anything. I'm sure as we go through, as we've gone through history with education and quality control and all the various issues that can be discussed.
And a lot of it is, it's really controlling people. Mm. And that's what the government is doing by putting these regulations in. And, you know, you go way back in history. Yeah. Who ended up in jail?
Yeah.
It certainly wasn't me and my neighbors.
I think from my perspective, with talking to people writing this book, I've even had people ask me not to write it. Don't be promoting that this happens. That's not a good journalism to not write about something that's mainstream part of our culture now.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And always has been.
But I think it's the fear of the criminal element and the stories that we've all heard have happened. So I think that legislation element of making this a safe, making dispensaries a safe place to go and having the grows regulated and safe for neighbors and things, that's really probably the driving factor.
And another driving factor is how people are making money on this, and how corporations are going to be taking over.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it's just going to be like cigarettes, alcohol, or anything else that you're purchasing.
I've tackled that in the book. Yeah. I have. As we travel through, it's sort of a road trip story, and as we travel through the region up into the Emerald Triangle, I've incorporated mom and pop grows from the 60s, more recent grows that legitimize, and then we get into the whole cartel situation, and then we kind of come around again and discuss, you know, the potential for local farms, and so I've really done my best to go at it from every angle here so that we can look at this as something that's happening, going to continue to happen. We need to make it safer, better legislated, make it so it works.
Right. Well, it's interesting because I go up to the Humboldt County into the Eel River, and we're in Garberville or Redway, and the grocery stores, I mean, are packed with people, and they all have these huge trucks, and so they're getting in and out of difficult, you know, terrain.
Yes.
And there is nothing but $100 bills just floating.
Cash.
So it's a boon for that area.
Well,
it was really in a depression because of what its previous industry, which was mostly timber.
Yeah, and it's actually had a big impact, a negative economic impact, the legalization to some extent in that area.
Yeah.
And of course, because the regulations are pretty intense, it's not easy for people to start up their own businesses and do all of the things you need to do to be certified and be legally able to do it. So there's still this big black market.
Yes, yeah.
And a similar thing happened after Prohibition, where there was this other market. In fact, I was just reading about this recently. One of the Carlo Gambino, he made a killing off of this new market that developed as a black market, selling liquor that was not legal. Even though Prohibition had gone away, they were able to sell this stuff because it was cheaper, because they didn't have the tax to deal with.
Well, I think, like Janice said earlier, that the extra money that you spend to go to a dispensary when you can buy it from.
Right.
Yeah.
So, 26%, versus.
Yeah. So if you over, I mean, it's proof that if you make it too difficult, people will still rely on an underground alternative.
Yeah. I mean, I think definitely I've tried to portray in the book, it's still hugely, very much the Wild West as far as all this. And it's going to be, I think it's going to be a decade or more before things really start to get sorted out.
Well, and we had this was just a year or two ago, I think. Maybe it's been 2 years now. We had a situation where some people drove all the way from the East Coast to rob what they thought was a pot farm in Petaluma.
Yes, yeah.
And it was actually wasn't even them. Yeah. It was those people had moved away a long time ago. So this innocent family has nothing to do with it.
These people coming to their doors.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they were
robbing them.
Fortunately, no one was killed or injured. I think the guy got maybe hit with a pistol or something like that, but they were tied up or something. And they didn't find anything. There was nothing to take. But that exists because it's not federally legal. So there's an incentive for people to take it out of state from places where it is legal. And so until we make it nationally legal, I think we're still going to have problems.
Yeah,
I imagine you've got into that in the book.
And really, one of the main thrusts of this book is from the women's perspective in this arena, and young girls going up into the grows and trimming, and so the human trafficking element. Yeah. And so there's a lot of very important issues that I've touched on in this book. And I was very surprised when I first started writing about it and discussing it with, you know, friends and neighbors and people I know around town, and the amount of people that have young teenagers who have no idea there's plenty more whose teenagers have gone up there and done that and been fine, thankfully. But it is really important that we educate each other, and we do know that there is still that very dangerous element.
Absolutely. And particularly, I mean, what do you do if they decide not to pay you? Who do you go to? You go to the police for an illegal, you know, grow farm?
Not to the Roanoke Park Police Department.
But that, I mean, there's this show, and it's gotten some criticism, Murder Mountain. I don't know if you've seen that.
Well, I have been. Everyone has asked me, have you watched? And I've deliberately not, because that Myers Flat area, one of my farms in the fictional farms in the book is set there, and it's a very different setting from the story in that documentary or whatever. Is it a documentary?
It's like a docudrama series kind of thing.
And so I deliberately haven't watched it because I didn't want to cross paths with that story. I would say Big Green Country is a very different aspect of.
So it's not as dark.
Oh, no, it is. Oh, no, it is.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah. But I think, I would say that I've told it through a very different perspective, but it's. It's a very dark book. Yes.
Wow. Have you seen the Murder Mountain thing?
I have not.
I haven't either.
So, yeah, it's a series that's about illegal pot farms. Murder Mountain. Yeah, and specifically in the Emerald Triangle area. Yeah. And there's a particular area they call Murder Mountain. I can't remember.
Myers Flat.
Yeah. And apparently there's been a lot of people that have gone missing, and there's a lot of people that have shown up dead. And there's just a lot of unfortunate crime that's been happening. And it's a variety of ways. Sometimes it's people trespassing into pot farms. Sometimes it's people that are working for pot farms, and then something goes bad in the relationship. But I think it's a difficult show because if you look at the scheme of things, it's actually not, it sort of exaggerates the problem in my mind and I told someone that my brother lives in the area, and they're like, oh my God, you don't want to go there. You're going to get shot. It's like, come on.
Well, it's formulaic. They those shows, they like to kind of get everybody riled up in an extra special way, you know? But I did go up to the region and research with my dog by myself.
There are places it will happen. I show this in the documentary where you'll get to a place and it's almost like this little militia situation where they're checking you, you know, before they allow you to pass on some of these roads.
You definitely don't want to go off road.
No.
Hiking and rambling around anywhere up in that region in the next decade. And actually in the in Fog Valley Winter, my previous book, there's a whole chapter on mushroom foraging in this region, closer to home to us. Yeah. And I did get to talk to the family that took me out there. Had told me, we have to be careful on these big properties.
Yeah.
If we see pipes and things, it's evidence that there has been an illegal grow.
Right.
A lot of those were small, but these guys were kidnapped from South America. They're told if they don't stay for the summer and tend the grow, that their families will be killed. So they get stuck on these private properties in the middle of nowhere, and they tend that particular grow until the end of the season, and then they either get to go home or not. I mean, it really is a serious issue.
But I think that's the other point is, I mean, you kind of have to be looking to get into it. I mean, it's not like you're going to be walking around Richardson Grove and or downtown Garberville and, I mean, come on. It's not like it's that dangerous.
I think it's so cautious to be aware.
I think it is.
You have to be really cautious when you go over the bridge to go to the Lost Cove or wherever.
Yeah, yeah.
I never go off off-road. I just stay on the main road where there was a time I wouldn't have even thought twice about going off onto the roads and, you know, stopping and maybe hiking. Oh. I would never consider that now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the crime element that's up in the Garberville area, it's just really sad for the people who, multi-generational people
that's
who
right.
live there and want to, you know, want to carry on having a harmonious community. And so I'd stayed in that town while I was doing research and have my dog is a rescue dog. She's Doberman cattle dog shepherd mix, so she looks pretty serious, even though she's very much a softie.
Yeah.
She's very devoted to me. But I had tied her up at the little motel I was staying at one morning to run in and get some bagels and coffee from their little breakfast buffet. And the waitress came rushing out and said to me, "Don't leave your dog for a second, because she'll go. Somebody will take her. She'll be gone."
Wow.
And I mean, I'm not into leaving her for half an hour at a time or anything, but I would have been able to have seen her from the breakfast bar. So I was, really a little taken aback and that was in March. It wasn't even in the height of the season. So there's a lot of transients that stay up there that don't even necessarily get the work, but they're hanging out to get the.
Because they go there, it's like a magnet also. They think they might get the work.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting series, but I look forward to reading your book.
Yes, thank you.
That sounds very interesting. And I don't want you to give more of it away necessarily, but is there sort of a conclusion that you get to that?
Ooh, without doing a spoiler. Well, the two sisters are the protagonists in their late 40s, early 50s that have been left with this ranch, failed dairy ranch out on the Sonoma coast. And their big question for them is, how are they going to keep this property? How are they going to maintain it?
Mm-hmm.
What are they going to do with it going forward to keep it in their families, multi-generational? And so they're going through this whole experience, good and bad. They're considering whether they may go towards having a legalized grow out there. And I don't think that's a spoiler to say that. So we kind of come all the way through this big saga of a story, and then I'm leaving the book open, so they haven't fully made their decision. And I'm thinking it would be really interesting to wait for a couple of years and see what happens with legislation and crime and community support and then pick up their story a couple of years down the line. So they haven't told me yet what they're going to do.
What is true is that, you know, when you have a farm, you have multiple generations, and, you know, the farming is changing. Mm-hmm. And so then, you know, the parents die, the grandparents, the parents, and then what are the family members left with? A lot of times they have to divide the farms up.
Yeah.
You know, so they have to create a way of making money.
And maybe there's something new and some new way about of going about things and making things safer that we don't know yet, that hasn't been established. And so it's going to be really interesting for me to follow the story journalistically and then weave that into.
Were there any big surprises that you came across in your research on the subject? Or, I mean, anything big that stands out that you learned that you didn't know before?
I think just the growing awareness of how mainstream the medical marijuana industry is becoming, and how many people, you know, elderly people and cancer sufferers are really are really benefiting from having all these different products, as we were talking about earlier, not necessarily smoking anymore, but all those.
Or not even getting high.
Yes.
I mean, people use CBD just for pain.
So I have one fictionalized.
I'm not sure if they're using it for cancer pain and things like that.
Absolutely.
With the cancer issues, when people have, you know, loss of appetite,
And then that's true, right.
Also reduces nausea and things associated with chemo.
But without the CBD?
No, with CBD.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. And just to...
Without THC.
Right. Yeah.
The THC is the psychoactive element.
So, yes, the fictionalized dispensary that I've created in one of the chapters, I really got to explore sharing the stories of how it's been used for the betterment of a lot of people's suffering and, the quality control aspects of it. So I feel like it's been... really great to be able to talk about those aspects in this story. And I sent a copy to my mother in the little town where I grew up, and they have a lending library where my previous book was the most read book of the year last 2 years ago.
That's exciting.
So I'm thinking they are really, because, you know, it's not legal in the UK, so I'm thinking that little town's going to be very knowledgeable.
Yeah, it's interesting that parts of Europe seem a little behind the curve on this, where in so many other areas they're so far ahead.
I mean, they are and they aren't.
Depends on the country, but like Germany, I was there not too long ago, and it's still illegal. They don't really enforce it if it's small amounts.
The research is going on, though. Yeah. I mean, Cambridge University has all sorts of research going on and labs. And
they sell CBD, actually. When I was in Hanover, I saw some shops with the non-psychoactive CBD tinctures and things like that.
And I think, actually, Israel is one of the biggest...
Medical?
Leaders in for medical.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, whenever there's money behind something, it kind of changes things. I mean, even John Boehner now is a big advocate for...
Wasn't he on the board immediately, one of the board?
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, he used to be, disturbed.
But I think the awareness of the opioid...
Well, that's the other thing. There's an alternative to opioid use.
Yeah. Which was, a man-made problem.
Oh. Yes.
And, now we have all the, so many people with mental health issues on the street, and that is, we don't know what stuff is cut with.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I have written a little about that in this book, too, and the fentanyl issue recently.
Right.
In our Sonoma County community. It's a terrible tragedy.
Went down to the Tenderloin for $125, bought heroin and with fentanyl and whatever else is in it, and baby's dead and he is.
A friend of mine thinks the reason they haven't done it in Germany is because of the strength of the alcohol lobby.
Well, that's the same
beer is a big deal.
Yeah,
over there.
Lobby.
Yes, I don't know if that's true or not, but
well, it may well be.
It all circles back to who's making money and what corporation wants to go ahead and jump on board.
It's interesting, though.
For the stock.
They allow prostitution in Germany. So it's like you can't buy a joint, but I don't know. Anyway.
Well, there's no rationalization.
Right, exactly.
I mean, just the combo is
the person's need, you know the law.
But anyway. So the state of legalization, I mean, I think it's only a matter of time that we do that nationally here. It seems like it's probably one of the few bipartisan issues, actually. So I just heard a Republican actually complain about Biden's comment, because Biden made a comment about how he's still not sure if marijuana is a gateway drug or not, and more research needs to be done. And one of my least favorite people in Congress, Representative Gates, has been getting some press lately. He was apparently one of the people that ridiculed Biden over, called him a boomer because of that. So even Republicans I don't like, I support the idea of legalization. Partly it's generational, too. I mean, he's younger. I think he's in his 30s or something.
Yeah, and my oldest son, who's 28, he's a multimedia editor in Los Angeles, and he concept edited the first two or three revisions of this book with me. I wanted to make sure I wasn't writing a mom book on marijuana.
That might do well.
Last year when we were at the at the event that's coming up this weekend.
Yeah, the Emerald.
The Emerald Cup. All of a sudden, this one young man came up to us. He goes, yeah, my mom called him Doobies. And he just and I just thought, oh, my God, I feel so old.
Remember when we couldn't even open the bag? The joint container. And we went up to this guy, and he's like, don't you just squeeze it? I'm like, oh, okay. I think the Kava is we had already experimented a little bit before.
Well, we were at the Kava bar.
The Kava bar.
Oh, yeah, the Kava bar.
Yeah. And it was flooding last year, too. Yeah. So when you start writing, do you have a program that you use to keep chapters or?
No, I'm very low-tech as far as my writing. I think there are all sorts of really wonderful programs, and I probably, if I ever had the time to not write and to learn one of those, it would be useful, I'm sure.
Right.
But so, no, I still have a file.
You don't use a typewriter, though, right?
No.
Some people do.
No, I did start my journalistic career with typewriter. Yeah, in the newsrooms and big pile of paper.
We had a big IBM.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But no, I use an old Mac laptop and have gazillion versions of the. So I always have to be very good about putting the date on the latest version.
Yeah, save
it. Otherwise, it can be scary. And I have lots of memory sticks around my house with the latest version. Yeah, and then I keep I print out all my research and you know wherever I find anything I print it. So I still have all the hard copies of that because it is useful to go back and. You know, sometimes during a revision period, I'll think, oh, what, I remember reading about that. Mm-hmm. You know, what would she do in that situation? And then I can pull it out. And I'm really old school as far as that goes.
That's good. So you have three sons?
Three sons.
And what age is 28?
Rocco's 28. He's in Los Angeles.
And what does he do?
He does primarily post-production music video editing. He doesn't like me to boast, so I won't boast too much. But he works on some pretty big music videos editing.
I wonder if he uses any of the products I'm involved with.
Maybe. have to ask him. Yeah. And then he does some of his own production work too. So he's really got himself into. It took several years being down in LA to keep working. Yeah. But he's finally into that arena where he's really got a good name for himself. So I'm very proud of him. And his Petaluma schools all the way through.
What's his name?
Rocco Rivetti.
Oh, no. I think I actually have met the guy. The name sounds really
familiar.
He
looks like John Lennon.
I think I...
He did. He was a JC...
You know, it's not a huge industry, the music post.
JC student, and he transferred to UC Berkeley, and then he went down to LA, and it's been really good. And then Luke is 24. He's in San Francisco working in the tech industry. He went to UC Santa Cruz.
Okay.
And then Dominic is 21, and he's just finishing UC Davis a couple of quarters early.
Nice. And what's he graduating?
Plant biology and anthropology.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
How do I spell his name?
Rocco, R-O-C-C-O.
C-C-O, okay.
Yeah. So, yes, no, I'm there. Between the three of them, the 3 years of me writing this book, someone would be home regularly, and I have a lovely blue little velvet couch in my study, and I love nothing more than when one of them is sitting on it, having a cup of tea or reading, and Dominic would be home more from UC Davis, he'd read his National Geographic and bring me cups of tea and hang out. And so I've always written from home primarily after the third boy was born, because it worked out better that way for me to be able to stay home and freelance.
Nice.
So they've grown up with me writing, and I can write with anything, any kind of chaos around me. Soccer balls and reptiles.
Chaos is good.
So what was the family's reaction when they first discovered that you were going to be writing on this subject?
I think that initially my sons were just, as I said earlier, they wanted to have some input to make sure I really knew what I was doing with this and not, you know, not going into having too much of a bias either way. Mm. And also with me not being native Northern Californian, it's great to have them being native Northern Californians because they can keep me in check with my British attitudes towards things, you know, and balanced me out a little bit.
Yes.
So that's good. My husband's always been completely behind anything that I write. He's super supportive, which is wonderful. I couldn't do it without that, his support. And my family in the UK, my younger sister, I have a journalist sister and then an older brother and then a sister as a teacher. My teacher sister was very concerned about me going up there and the stories I would tell her about my research. And she just said, couldn't you write about something really nice?
That's exciting.
She's read it and she loved it. She's sharing it with all her friends in London. And so they're all proud of me.
That's awesome.
Good. Okay, so I've been watching on Netflix The Crown, you know.
Oh, yes.
And the more I'm watching it, the more... I just don't like the idea of just so white privileged and to think that somebody, you're supposed to bow to somebody. And just watching this whole, you know, process of...
the whole royalty thing?
Just the whole royalty thing.
Well, yeah, we're Americans. We don't believe in that.
Well, no. As an American, I mean, I follow that. Following this.
But we had a king and we said no.
Well, that is true. And we have somebody that wants to be king. Yeah, and we're still trying to say no.
He may very well be.
We never know. But it's just, you know, my whole attitude is kind of... shifted.
Yeah.
And instead of exciting and wanting to see this and the pomp and circumstance, it's not my thing anymore.
It's a theft.
Well, there's more to it, a lot more to it than that. Yeah, going back to history and heritage and culture.
Is very interesting.
And I was back in the UK this summer, and I have never been to Kensington Palace. I've been to all the other palaces and things. But I finally did get to go and walk through. There was an exhibit on Victoria. It's a beautiful place, and walking through Hyde Park to get there. And if we keep, I think if the Brits keep some small, functioning, hard-working faction of the royal family, they're keeping that history and heritage alive, and it brings trillions and billions into the country,
mm-hmm.
you know, through that. So I'm not a proponent of getting rid of the royalty, but I do think with what we've seen with Prince Andrew and those kind of stories, they really need to trim it down mm-hmm. and have it be the key family members representing that, carrying on with that culture and history and not having all the extended entourage, which I think The Crown does definitely... you know, it does make that clear that it's this is not really where we are in...
Well, and how is the wealth derived?
Now?
That's my point.
Yeah, well, they're definitely... I'm not going to go back into...
And that's the same with us. I mean, what did we do? We came here and we stole it from the Native Americans.
History is important. And it really does matter, so you understand what's happening today and what will
and
happen.
I think the elements of... you know, when you get rid of the pomp and splendor and some of the ridiculous stuff, the elements of decorum and I think we can do with more of that.
Well, some of them do really good work. Some of the members of the royal family.
Yeah, they do.
So I don't mean to slide.
I will still continue watching.
Yeah, it's more the
principle. You know, when things come up, I mean, you just gravitate.
Well, personally, I am a Prince Charles fan. I can't wait to see him.
Really?
Well, not that I wish the Queen to pass away.
I'm more of a Diana.
He's done amazing things for the environment, and he's very progressive for the farming and food and ecology and environment.
How did you vote, do you think, in this last election?
That's a good question, actually.
Because it didn't go
I don't know if they're allowed to vote. Yeah.
Oh, really?
I don't know. That is a good question. I have to look that up.
Huh. Yeah. No, but he is much more progressive than he was. And then kind of, it seems like, put on the sideline.
Yes.
Because that was just not the direction the country or the Crown was going to go.
And I think that the Crown did handle that episodes with him going to Wales. That was brilliant.
Well, brilliant.
One of the arguments, for leaving the EU is that they don't have to conform to EU environmental regulations. So that's kind of why I asked the question. You mentioned Prince Charles is an advocate for environmental protection. What does he think about this?
Is
history just really changing because of the time frame? you know, the people just forget about a part of history, and then we start to repeat it again.
Yes.
And then we learn it, and then we repeat it again.
Yeah, the fog of history.
And that's where I feel like we're at in this country and in the world.
That's why we try to get people to remember the Holocaust and things.
Yes,
know.
Yeah.
But...
Wow, this was a deep discussion. It's
really interesting. I enjoy hearing what you have to say, and you know, the books that you've written and the whole process.
I remembered my question though, which I didn't ask. Are you going to do a audio version of this?
Yes, I am.
Cool.
Yes.
With your voice.
Well, sadly, I'm not going to do it personally.
What?
Because why do you think that would be? The dialogue. I have a very British accent.
Yeah. No, that's great.
No, I couldn't.
No, it sounds authoritative.
I could do it for the other books, but not this one. This one, I had a local proofread, a lovely lady called Brenda Bellinger.
So you want
worked
to
with me. She grew up in this area, and she worked with me intensely on the right at the end, after we thought we'd got rid of all the Britishisms, on really Americanizing the whole, you know, everything I've written, not just the dialogue, but just tiny little nuances that I didn't realize were still in there. So
you say whilst a few times?
No, I say all sorts of funny things.
It's kind of like when Marie McCusker, when she was talking about trolleys.
Well, there's some funny ones that could be another discussion for another time. I've got a whole list of them that we had a good laugh about. But
that's cool, though. So you're going to have the audio version.
Yeah, but the characters, especially the one sister, Bridget, that never left the ranch, she's, you know, really worked hard on making her voice authentic Northern California coastal. Cool. And so I couldn't pass that off with my
right.
British accent.
Well, we are out of time.
Oh, that was fast.
Yes, it did go fast, didn't it? I want to thank you, Frances, for being here today.
Thank you.
Talking to Frances Rivetti, if you're just tuning in. You missed a great discussion if you're just tuning in. But anyway, thank you for being
here. Thank you.
And your book is available down at Copperfields.
Yes.
And
online and all the usual suspects.
Yes. Okay, so I guess that's it. We'll see you next week.
I guess Friday's over.
How about some music?
There
we go. You've been listening to Inside Petaluma. We're here every Friday from 11 to noon. So do come back and be with us again next week. You can also hear archive shows at InsidePetaluma.com. And you can also see us on Facebook at KPCA Inside Petaluma. Alrighty.
See you
Thanks,
next
everybody.
Week.
See you all next week.
Thanks.